Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 9th of May, these are our main stories. Human Rights Watch says the paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan may have committed genocide in West Darfur. A former Saudi intelligence officer tells the BBC that Saudi Arabia has permitted the use of lethal force to clear land for a futuristic desert city. And Japan is to start hunting fin whales, whose conservation status is described as vulnerable. Also in this podcast, can an amputee become an astronaut? One man is training exactly for that.
In the capsule, the G-load is going straight down the line of my femur, so pushing the socket onto my residual limb.
All that and Under the Hammer, Shirley Bassey's glittering collection of jewels. But first, in conflicts, the people who often suffer most are not the armed factions, but the civilians stuck in the middle. Nowhere is that more true than in West Darfur in Sudan. For more than two decades, the Masalit people there, a black African ethnic group, have been targeted by Arab factions. Now there are warnings from Human Rights Watch that the attacks may amount to genocide. The charges against the Rapid Support Forces and their allied militias, which have been involved in a civil war against the government. The report focuses on the West Darfur city of El Janina, where it says thousands of civilians were killed last year. Here's Jean-Baptiste Galopin from Human Rights Watch describing one of the worst incidents.
The column came under attack early in the morning on June 15th by the RSF and allied militias who opened fire on the crowd and then deliberately killed large numbers of civilians. The accounts we heard were horrific, you know. Hundreds of people trying to swim across the river, many drowning, and still, you know, coming under attack, being shot at by the RSF and militias.
Our Africa correspondent Barbara Pletasha told me more about last year's attacks.
The RSF clashed with the Sudanese military in El Janina on April 24th, and then it started to attack these majority Masalit neighborhoods, which were initially defended by Masalit armed groups. But even after that, Human Rights Watch says, the RSF continued to systematically target unarmed civilians. And then the violence culminated in this large-scale massacre on the 15th of June. So this was after the Masalit governor had been killed. And there were thousands of people who fled in this kilometers-long convoy. And the allegation is that the RSF and the militias pursued, rounded them up, shot them, men, women and children, and so on.
Barbara, there have been repeated attacks against the Masalit and other groups in Darfur over more than 20 years. And there have been repeated allegations of genocide, haven't there? But nothing perhaps has changed.
Well, the main allegations of genocide came after the ethnic violence around 20 years ago. And then the UN put forward a peacekeeping force, which did have some impact in protecting civilians. But that was withdrawn a number of years ago. And the attacks started to happen periodically after that. But this attack on El Janina, which Human Rights documents, talks about what it says is very systematic targeting. It concludes that the RSF and its allies are guilty of crimes against humanity and war crimes, which it says were committed in the context of an ethnic cleansing campaign. And then it goes further and says that ethnic cleansing campaign might constitute genocide if there was an intention with these attacks to actually clear out El Janina, to actually destroy that community of Masalit, at least in West Darfur, that would indicate genocide. So it calls on the international community to investigate the facts to see whether that intent that would underline a charge of genocide exists.
You say that might happen. Could that be the impact of this report? Some process being started?
Well, there is a process that has been started. So the International Criminal Court had been looking at the allegations of genocide from the ethnic violence 20 years ago, and it was reactivated to investigate what was happening in Darfur, including in El Janina. And the prosecutor for the ICC has told the Security Council that there are strong grounds to believe that both the army and the RSF are committing what he calls Rome Statute crimes in Darfur. Now, Rome Statute crimes are war crimes. They also include genocide, but he did not specifically mention genocide. I'm sure that Human Rights Watch would hope that this report would provide evidence and material for the ICC prosecutor's case.
Barbara Plaitascher. Historically, Sierra Leone has had strong relations with Western countries, including the UK. But now the foreign minister there, Timothy Musakaba, has announced that Russia will reopen its embassy in the capital, Freetown, after more than three decades. The move is expected before the end of the year. Since several countries in the region, Niger, Mali and Burkina Faso, are now moving towards Moscow, the BBC's James Copnell asked Musakaba if this represented a shift in foreign policy.
Now, Sierra Leone is still one of the... The UK remains one of the strongest allies of Sierra Leone. It's not a shift in foreign policy. Rather, we're expanding our reach to every corner of the world, given the geopolitical context of the world. And bearing in mind that Sierra Leone today plays a key leadership position in the UN Security Council, it makes Sierra Leone a very attractive country. Our foreign policy is without exclusion, but we haven't shifted, and the UK and the West remains a reliable and long-standing partner of the people and government of Sierra Leone.
Because this is, of course, a rather divided world right now, not least because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You mentioned there Sierra Leone's role on the Security Council for the next couple of years and a non-permanent member. How do you then intend to navigate that very divided international context?
Well, I tell you what, I think Africa was caught up in the crux of the Cold War. In today's multipolar world of rather transactional international relations, I think Africa is trying to position itself in such a way that we are not brought into a situation of what happened during the Cold War. What we're trying to do basically is to ensure that we seek our continent's interests, particularly Sierra Leone. Unlike, you know, you made mention of countries like Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali, Sierra Leone is a very peaceful, democratic country in view of its trajectory from conflict to peace and its steadfast progression in democratic consolidation. And so rather than being at the losing end of what is more like a multipolar world, we're trying to find our own space to the benefit of the people of Sierra Leone.
In terms of that Russian connection then, I think you studied in Russia, you speak Russian.
That's correct.
You have that personal tie, I suppose. What are you looking for from Russia to get your voice heard in Moscow, of course, but are we talking about Russian investment in Sierra Leone? Are we talking about, we mentioned some of your neighbours bringing in Russian military advisors, military presence, is that something you would consider?
It is worth noting that Sierra Leone is a former British colony.
Sure.
And I studied in English as well, so there is no deleterious interest or advantage there. Is the fact that Sierra Leone's foreign policy is one that is looking for benefit, mutual respect, common interest and shared values. Yes, the Russian Federation and Sierra Leone have had over 60 years of bilateral relations. I think what we want to do is to deepen this relation. And also bear in mind that the Russian Federation is one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. So it is inevitable that we have to deal with the Russian Federation. I'm very proud that I'm a product of Russia. I had the opportunity of studying there. So I have a contextual understanding of the relationship between Sierra Leone and Russia. But that does not obviate Sierra Leone's traditional and very strong relationship with our Western allies.
Sure. But in concrete terms, investment, is that something you're looking for from Russia?
Absolutely. We're looking for investment. The president has set five game changers as his strategy for economic development. And so we're looking for those who can align with the president's agenda to develop agriculture and ensure that Sierra Leone is food sufficient and ensures that technology becomes part of the daily activities of Sierra Leoneans for us to compete in this technological age. And we also look for partners that will help create opportunities for Sierra Leoneans, especially the youth of our country.
Timothy Musa-Kaba talking to my colleague James Copnell. Saudi Arabia's plan to build a brand new city by the Red Sea was never going to be simple. Costing $500 billion, NEOM, as it's called, is part of the country's attempt to change its economy and its image. Tourism will be central. Visitors might be allowed to drink alcohol. But there have always been question marks. Was the project financially viable? Would tourists want to visit? And there was also the concern about the residents already living on the site where NEOM is being built, most in small villages. It turns out that Saudi police were told they could use lethal force to evict these locals. That's according to a former intelligence officer, as the BBC's Merlin Thomas reports.
This is NEOM.
NEOM, Saudi Arabia's grand plan to transform the country and its image. This promotional video shows a project almost the size of Belgium. It's being built by companies from all over the world. More than a dozen are from the UK, including McLaren Racing and engineering and design firms Arup and Atkins. At its heart is the line, a city carved from the desert, envisaged to be a 100-mile straight line. But only 1.5 miles will be reportedly built by 2030. NEOM's driving force is the country's leader, Mohammed bin Salman. He spoke about his vision for the city in a documentary for the Discovery Channel.
So since we have empty place and we want to have a place for 10 million people, then let's think from scratch.
But it wasn't empty. Near this new city, thousands of people lived in villages who for years objected to being moved. But still, the project went on. A former Saudi intelligence officer told us he was given orders to clear one of the villages near NEOM in 2020. He said security forces were permitted to kill those who refused eviction. Colonel Rabih Al-Anzi has been living in fear since he went into exile in the UK last year. He claims he was offered £4 million by the Saudi regime in exchange for his silence. But he refused.
The order said whoever continues to resist should be killed. So it licensed the use of lethal force against whoever stayed in their home. This was very harsh and I was shocked by it. The orders were never this brutal, like using lethal force against peaceful activists.
He says he dodged the mission which went ahead without him. One man, Abdurrahim Al-Hawaiti, was shot dead by Saudi forces after he refused to leave his home. The Saudi government says he was an armed terrorist who opened fire on security forces. But the UN and human rights groups say he was killed for refusing eviction. NEOM's grand plan also includes Trojena, a ski resort built in the desert. Andy Wirth became its CEO shortly after the shooting. He repeatedly asked about the killing of Abdurrahim Al-Hawaiti. He resigned after less than a year.
It was clearly unnecessary. It was clearly murder. You don't accelerate human progress at the detriment of other humans. You don't step on their throats with your boot heels so you can advance. That's not human progress.
40 people from 3 villages have been detained after objecting to the evictions, according to the human rights group Al-Qist. It says 5 villagers are on death row facing terrorism charges. The Saudi government and NEOM didn't respond to our questions about their cases. We looked at satellite images of villages where they lived. Homes, schools, hospitals have been wiped off the map. At least a dozen UK companies are involved in NEOM. Until recently, Solar Water was one of them. They walked away from a £100 million contract with NEOM. In an exclusive interview, their boss, Malcolm Orr, told us he began to feel the entire project was destructive for both the local environment and the people who lived there. He says companies involved in the project should do more.
If they're there and if things are happening, they can't ignore these things. Do something about it.
We put our findings to some of the British companies involved in the project. Engineering and design firms Atkins and Arup and racing company McLaren told us they take human rights concerns seriously and look at the broader context of projects and said any concerns must be reported. Mohammed bin Salman wants NEOM to be his legacy. A shining jewel in the desert, but critics say the project has cost some Saudis their freedom and their lives.
Merlin Thomas. Japan is just one of a handful of nations where whale hunting is still allowed. But despite the fact that fewer and fewer people there eat whale meat, the government has just announced that it's expanding hunting to another species. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told me more about the move.
Three species at the moment are allowed to be hunted by Japanese vessels. They've increased that to four. Importantly, the fourth species is a fin whale. Now, fin whales are far larger than the ones they've already been hunting down, twice as large, at least twice as large. So that's what they've announced. It can't be a coincidence, I don't think, that just a few weeks ago, a seafood company in Japan launched a new, really large whaling ship. And so the government's obviously trying to kind of push whaling. And, you know, despite the fact it's been abandoned, as you indicated there, by most countries, you know, Japan still believes that it's a part of its culture, part of its food culture, and it's certainly promoting whaling.
I know around the world there's a lot of opposition to whale hunting, but what about in Japan? How's it likely to be received there?
Well, it's a mix, really, because, of course, there are really vocal lobby, the fishing groups, fishermen and whalers, appeal to tradition and a traditional way of life. So that's a strong lobby. Of course, we are environmentalists as well, not just in Japan, but outside Japan. Japan's been whaling, actually, for a good few years. Initially, it got round restrictions on whaling by saying it was doing it for scientific purposes. Then 5 years ago, it said it was resuming commercial whaling. And last year, it hunted down about 300 whales. This now is definitely an expansion. And environmental groups will certainly be critical of this. Essentially, they'll be thinking as well, particularly with this new vessel, that Japan perhaps wants to expand whaling beyond its own waters to kind of other areas. Previously, it used to hunt in the Antarctic Ocean, and environmentalists will be worrying that they're going to return there.
Michael Bristow. Still to come on this podcast, how a former employee of Spirit Aerosystems, which supplies Boeing with components for the 737 MAX, has raised the alarm saying that some major parts left its factory with serious defects. It is Victory Day in Russia, which marks the defeat of Nazi Germany in the Second World War and commemorates the millions of Soviet citizens who died in the conflict. President Putin told members of the armed forces and the public who'd gathered in Moscow that Russia was living through a difficult time. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, was in the centre of the capital as the main parade took place.
Thousands of military personnel, more than 9,000 people, marching across Red Square in the snow. I say big parade, but this parade is actually not quite as big as it has been in previous years before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, in Russia, under Vladimir Putin, Victory Day has become pretty much the main secular national holiday, a day to remember the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany, but also the enormous cost of victory, the 27 million Soviet citizens who were killed in what's referred to here as the Great Patriotic War. So here comes the hardware. The Victory Day parade for Russia is an opportunity to project Russian power. Now, I mentioned the Second World War. Russia today isn't just remembering the past, it's weaponizing it to try to justify the present. So the authorities want the Russian public to view the war in Ukraine very much as a continuation of the Second World War. They want Russians to believe that once again, external forces are trying to destroy Russia. Nazi Germany then, Ukraine and the West today. While in reality, 2 years ago, it was Russia that attacked Ukraine, launching a full-scale invasion of its neighbor. From Vladimir Putin today, a warning to the West.
Russia will do everything to avoid a global confrontation. But at the same time, we will not allow anyone to threaten us. Our strategic forces are always on combat alert.
So a military flypast and the Russian tricolour in the sky brings this parade to an end. But there is no end in sight to the war in Ukraine, nor to the tension between Russia and the West.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Baidu is China's big search engine, and right now it's dealing with a public relations headache. That's after its own PR boss made some videos on social media that really struck a nerve. Here's our Asia business correspondent, Mariko Oi.
Her name is Chu Jing, and she basically released some video clips on TikTok's Chinese version called Zhou Yin, portraying herself as a tough-as-nails manager. And get this, she said that she has no responsibility for her staff's personal well-being. She also said that she's so devoted to the company that she doesn't know what grade her son is in. That's cool. And she also said that she has the power to make sure anyone who complains about her won't ever find a job in the industry. So as you can imagine, it caused a huge controversy and outcry. And many people have started coming out talking about how, you know, she often emails you at 1 a.m., making you work over the weekend and so on. So really a public relations nightmare.
Mariko Oi. It's been a very difficult year for the plane maker Boeing. In January, a section of door blew out from one of its 737 MAX jets at nearly 5,000 metres. The whole fleet was temporarily grounded. Now, a former employee of Spirit Aerosystems, that's a company which supplies Boeing with components for the 737 MAX, has raised the alarm by claiming that some major parts left its factory with serious defects. Here's Santiago Parades speaking to our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Anywhere from 50 to 100, 200.
You were regularly finding more than 100 faults on a plane that was being shipped.
Yeah. And that's because I just inspect certain areas. So in totality, with all the inspectors, if you total them out, yeah, you'll be over the hundreds.
Now, you were picking up on these faults. You were highlighting them. You were flagging them up to be repaired. What kind of response did you get from your managers? Did they support you?
My managers weren't always there. The production managers always made a fuss about why I was finding it, why I was looking at it, and they made a big fuss about everything that I ever found.
Theo Leggett told me more about the issue.
As you heard there, he became quite accustomed to finding large numbers of faults at the end of the production line. Now, that really shouldn't happen, you know. Things should be rectified as the process goes on. But also I asked him whether any of these faults were still on planes when they were sent to Boeing in Washington. And he said, yes, serious defects were finding their way through and were ending up in Boeing's factory. Now, you could say Boeing would be quite capable of remedying those problems itself. But don't forget that Boeing workers were under a great deal of time pressure, were under stress as well. So if you have faulty products arriving in a factory, there's no guarantee that they'll be noticed or rectified. So he also said that records weren't being kept as they should, and that when he raised this point, he was retaliated against. At one point, he was removed from a leadership role. He was made to work in a back office. And at that point, he actually wrote to the chief executive of the company saying, I'm at my wit's end. I don't know what to do. And these are planes that people will fly in. You know, it's a risky business.
And Theo, what's been the reaction now from the company Spirit and from Boeing?
Now, Spirit says it strongly disagrees with all of his allegations and will defend itself vigorously. It also says it'll defend that lawsuit vigorously. Boeing, which obviously is the customer here, you know, Spirit is its main supplier, hasn't commented. But insiders there say it's working hard behind the scenes to help Spirit resolve these issues, that it's had some success there, that the number of faults being shipped from the Wichita plant to Washington has been reduced by 80%. Both of them are under intense scrutiny at the moment from the Federal Aviation Administration in the United States to clean up their quality control procedures. And that largely stems from an incident earlier this year when a brand new 737 MAX flying out of Portland in Oregon lost a door panel in the early stages of flight, and that left a gaping hole in the plane. Nobody was hurt, but obviously it could have been a lot worse.
Theo Leggett. And what's the best way to train up an amputee astronaut for the challenges of space? John McFall, a former Paralympian, is taking part in the world's first study to look at the difficulties people with physical disabilities could face going into space and how to overcome them. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has visited the team from the European Space Agency to find out how he's getting on.
It's a key test for a trainee astronaut.
Any questions?
No questions.
But it's not for the faint-hearted or the claustrophobic.
All right, have fun.
With a slam of the door, John McFall is enclosed in a coffin-sized metal box.
3, 2, 1, ignition and lift off.
John is taking a spin in a giant centrifuge. He's being whizzed round and round at increasing speed to mimic the extreme gravitational forces he'd experience taking off in a rocket and coming back down again.
The faster it spins, the higher the G load is that you experience. And today we're going to be going up to about 6 Gs, so 6 times the force of gravity. It's designed to replicate what it would be like during re-entry into the atmosphere in a Soyuz capsule.
John's working with the European Space Agency to see if someone with a physical disability can go to space. He's an amputee. He lost the lower part of his right leg in a motorcycle accident when he was 19. Usually he wears a prosthesis, but for the centrifuge he's taken it off. It's a chance to see how the test affects his upper leg.
In the capsule, the G-load is going straight down the line of my femur, so pushing the socket onto my residual limb. So it's going to be a really good indication to see if it causes any significant discomfort or if I have any problems with it.
I'm in the control centre and there's a bank of screens here, and you can see John in one of them in his capsule. He's been smiling, so he looks okay so far, and the team can communicate with him. But they're also monitoring his health. They're checking to see if there are any effects on his heart, on his oxygen levels, so they can see exactly how his body is reacting.
So actually it was for us the first time that we actually had an amputee in the centrifuge.
Maybrit Kuipers is a flight surgeon for the European Space Agency.
They're basically lying on their back, and so this influences the blood flow also in the leg, and we were also curious to see how that would affect him, but it went really well.
It's the first time any space agency has carried out a project like this. Frank Tavina, who's in charge of ESA's Astronaut Centre, says he wants to open up space.
We think this is a great opportunity because we have so many great talents, people that have a disability, like we see John, but with so much talent, so much capabilities. And why should we not try to also harvest this talent? And I would really love to see John fly to space.
John's now about halfway through his feasibility study. He's not guaranteed a mission, but everything is progressing well so far, including this dizziness-inducing test.
Hello, John.
Hello.
Welcome back to Earth.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well done.
Do you know what? I didn't actually notice my right leg at all throughout the whole thing. It was probably the most comfortable part of me throughout the whole process. So, the socket... no comfort problems whatsoever. So that's, you know, really good to know for the flight study.
That report was by Rebecca Morell. And finally, as the song goes, diamonds are forever, at least until you decide to sell them. The woman who made the song famous, the veteran British singer Shirley Bassey, is doing just that. Shirley Bassey is auctioning off some of her dazzling jewellery collection, and the precious pieces are estimated to be worth nearly $750,000. David Lewis has the story.
Leave in the night, I've no fear that they might desert me. Diamonds are forever.
It's an eye-catching collection of bling up for fans with pockets as deep as their love of precious gemstones. Dame Shirley's lots include a diamond necklace expected to fetch upwards of $300,000. There are emerald earrings she wore for a royal performance in front of the late Queen Elizabeth, also up for the highest bidder. There's an aquamarine and sapphire gem set, as well as a $250,000 Cartier diamond and gold set. Not at all bad. And there's more. A gift from Elton John. The 1960s vintage heart-shaped ring covered in diamonds was given to her after she sang at one of his AIDS gala evenings. Dame Shirley said she'd worn the piece many times. The 87-year-old is perhaps most famed for singing the title track of the 1971 James Bond film Diamonds Are Forever. She took it on as she said the lyrics rang true to her. Collecting jewellery for me is like collecting memories, and this collection is full of them, she said. All the pieces are meaningful and have a story to tell, whether I bought them for myself or they were gifted to me. So why is the star getting rid of all the jewels and sparkle? It's all to support her charitable causes. The precious goods are going on display in London this month before moving to Paris for auction this October.
David Lewis reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sid Dundon. The producer was Oliver Burlow. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.